WOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Tune into KBOO for Bridge Over Troubled Water, a tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on Monday, January the 18th from noon to 5:30 p.m. This retrospective program honors Dr. King's work through a combination of archives, audio, and contemporary interviews featuring artists, activists, public officials, and community members who have participated in this event over the years. Bridge Over Troubled Waters draws inspiration from Dr. King's mission to ensure peace, social justice, civil rights, and human dignity for all. Again, that's Bridge Over Troubled Water, a tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, on Monday, January the 18th, from noon to 5:30 p.m., here on Community Radio, KBOO.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroot News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all of the things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race. Welcome to another edition of Let's Talk About Race. This is our first show of 2021 and among our most important. This is our eviction prediction show. Millions of Americans will face 10 years of debt, possible long-term houselessness, social drift downwards, all this occurring during a time of an airborne pandemic, and these eviction moratoriums are much too little, much too late.
Dear mama, there's a note on the door. It said we got 30 days, then we gotta roll. I know we all we got, so we got nowhere to go. Said we going through hell, now we out in the cold. Dear mama.
Well, the CDC moratorium was set to expire at the end of the month. This new moratorium will start just after midnight tonight. Now, there are mixed emotions tonight surrounding this. Tenants, as you can imagine, are a little less worried, but rental property owners are a bit concerned.
But it's at the point now where on the 8th, we got a 7-day to pay or quit.
Spencer Howard Jr. says he was on the brink of being evicted as the governor extended the eviction moratorium through the spring.
It's definitely a little bit of an ease off of my shoulders knowing that they can't just throw everybody out.
Like thousands of others, he is trying to navigate his unemployment claim for benefits. He is filing an appeal but says his unemployment profile won't work.
If I can get my case reset so that I can actually get online to get into my case, then I can file the appeal.
This new moratorium put in place in Nevada prohibits evictions, but it does not protect evictions from lease breaches for things like unlawful activity or nuisance.
The first couple of months, she started paying a couple of weeks late every month, and then eventually she just stopped paying it altogether.
Marissa Mastro owns 3 rental properties. She had a tenant who was still working and taking advantage of the last moratorium.
When he decided to extend it again, I almost started crying because it's so hard because we have bills too. You know, we have mortgages as landlords. We have mortgages, HOAs, taxes, insurance. There's nothing to protect the landlord.
It's a complicated process, leaving many in the triad without options after they're served an eviction order.
Every single shelter, every single rental assistance group, and there's nothing. Like, the shelters are full, like, they're totally busy. We interact with a lot of people that are just trying to survive.
A staff attorney for Legal Aid of North Carolina says the cases they're seeing now are new filings because the CDC doesn't actually stop landlords from starting eviction proceedings. Tenants who are at risk of losing their homes have to fill out this declaration form, and many don't know about it. So far in December, the Randolph County Sheriff's Office has served 8 writs of possession. Forsyth County deputies served 15 and have 29 more outstanding. A spokesperson for the department says the office is obligated to serve paperwork within 5 days. Sheriff Bobby Kimbrough said he would like to stop evictions, but the only person who can is Chief Justice Beasley. He shared on Facebook that he has compassion and sympathy for those facing hardship. An organizer with Housing Justice Now says that won't help those already facing eviction.
You know, they might be elderly, disabled, they have a house that is full of sewage, and they qualify for the CDC moratorium, and, you know, they still get kicked out of their house.
Housing or lack thereof. I am worried that after the rental moratoriums expire, we're going to have a whole lot of people who are unable to rent, who are going to get evicted. I'm just... blows my mind that this wasn't thought out better, but of course, there's no federal leadership. Nia Gray, you're an expert in housing. You're our faith reporter. Tell us what's going on.
So when COVID hit, there were some eviction moratorium protections so that landlords couldn't evict residents based on non-payment of rent. Sort of put a Band-Aid on that gaping, bleeding hole of folks that are living paycheck to paycheck and have housing insecurity, and the pandemic just exacerbated that. And as we come to the fall, many states were already extending their eviction moratoriums. First it was June, then it was July. And so recently, the CDC made a historic nationwide eviction moratorium. So across the country, you can't evict anyone temporarily until January 2021 under that particular order, which has helped about 30 to 40 million people who were at risk of losing their homes during the pandemic. However, the language has been there's been a lot of loopholes in it. And I've spoken to my customers about it because I do work in the real estate industry, where they found some loopholes in this so-called nationwide order. One, landlords can actually start the eviction process for non-payment of rent as long as they don't go through with it in this particular moratorium. However, in Milwaukee, they're actually currently evicting people who don't sign a required declaration that says, I've been affected by COVID negatively, either health-wise or employment-wise, and that's why I can't pay my rent. However, the landlords are not required to tell the renters about this declaration, and it doesn't seem like there's anyone actually explaining to the residents the protections that they're entitled to. So I think there's just going to be a lot of misunderstanding. There's a lot of communication, and unfortunately, a lot of families are going to suffer. So the moratorium is applicable if there's no serious breaches in the lease. However, a landlord can still evict you if there's property damage, breaches in the lease, drug activity. The moratorium doesn't apply to that. And so, it's just like a Band-Aid.
Excuse me, Faith Reporter. I just want to throw in the caveat that there are other things landlords can evict you on, such as having too many people who live in the apartment doubled up. You know, we have relatives now who are doubled up. We have grandparents taking care of grandchildren so their parents who are essential workers can work. You can get an eviction notice for using too much water or having your lights on all night, right? You talk about sure. Other things besides non-payment of rent.
Right. So I guess if a landlord really wants to get you out because you're not paying your rent, that they could go through your lease with a fine tooth comb and find different places where you're in breach so that they can actually go through with the eviction process. Unfortunately, when this moratorium expires, housing advocates are predicting a tsunami of evictions and an increase in homelessness and housing insecurity.
That just blows my mind. And we're talking about single women, a lot of women of color, poor families. We're going to start seeing little children in tents.
Sure. I mean, it's sad. It's really sad to think about it. And not just that. So the initial sort of hit with the tsunami of evictions is the homelessness, kids in tent, families that are living in their cars. However, the longer term effects of this moratorium, one of the delayed worst outcomes is the missed housing payments. And how there's millions of dollars of debt that's being accrued by renters. And we've seen it really high, up to 30% at the beginning of the pandemic. Now it's kind of flattened out. But for African American and Hispanic renters, they didn't pay their full August payment, and they've started September owing at least $1,000 in missed rent and other types of fees. So what happens is this rent is not forgiven. It keeps adding up with late fees unless the landlords waive it. So the pandemic, in addition to the homelessness, it's exacerbated these longstanding concerns around, you know, housing insecurity for people of color who don't have the credit, don't have the income to rent certain places. Back to the conversation about affordability, how there's more A-class lease-ups where you need perfect credit to get in, or when you have okay credit and maybe an eviction on your record, then you actually have to go get a co-signer or else they won't lease to you. So are we going to have a new generation of renters who are not qualified to rent unless these landlords lower their thresholds for applicants? And Hispanic and African-American renters are more likely to owe unpaid rent with rates up to 48%, especially in this C-class or affordable type of real estate.
Well, Nia, one last thing before I move on to our other panelists. I want Althea, news director, KBOO Radio, to chime in because Pacific Northwest has been at the forefront of rental moratoriums. What about the small landlord? I used to be a small landlord. I owned just a few properties. If my tenants didn't pay their rent, I couldn't pay my mortgage. Therefore, I would lose that asset. What about us?
That's correct. And I am not sure. Maybe one of the other hosts can speak to it. If there's any type of loan or late forgiveness on the loans for the single family owners who rent it out or folks that own small duplexes and things like that. But you're absolutely right. You have someone in your unit that's not paying rent, not providing rent revenue for you. So then you have to go and maybe take out a loan or some type of agreement with your bank so that you don't default on your loan. But I have seen articles that this is going to devastate the, you know, sort of individual real estate investor that has a little bit of property, and property looked really good, right, as an investment 10 years ago compared to the stock market, depending on what market you're in. It's interesting though, because those mid-market multifamily companies are actually in a position to start buying things up. So I'm actually seeing a lot of acquisitions at a certain level. For the larger players, that they're just gobbling up these smaller properties.
Because this really could be catastrophic, and it extends beyond just the rental industry. It could actually affect the single family housing market and the economy as a whole. Well, I think there's actually evictions already in process, right? So what happened in many states is that even though there was a moratorium on actually evicting somebody, you could actually proceed with the court case. Most states, you need a court case to evict somebody. So there are already evictions in process. You know, some of those would have probably been happening without COVID, and it's not clear how many of those are COVID-related. So yeah, there's certainly evictions in process. With the end of the moratorium, people are already probably getting kicked out of their houses.
How proactive do you think landlords are likely to be given how weak the economy is? I mean, it's one thing to evict somebody to get another paying tenant in, but we face a very difficult time, I would imagine, for them to find other tenants right now.
Yeah, so there's not great data on this. There's some anecdotal things that I've come across where, you know, obviously some landlords are being very helpful to their tenants and some are not. But certainly if you kick a tenant out, I don't know where you're going to get a new tenant at this time. And this is why, you know, this can create a bigger crisis. It could morph into a financial crisis because the renter's payment is the landlord's income that they pay the mortgage with. So no rent means maybe less landlords paying their mortgages. That could lead to a decrease in home values, even in the owner-occupied market, because these markets have gotten more intertwined since the financial crisis.
No, it's a great point, not to mention that just when you're talking about something of this scale, it'll have a lot of ripple effects. What localities do you think could see this happen at the biggest scale?
I really think it's a national problem, so it needs a national solution from the Congress. We have seen that in different locales, obviously people have different laws. Here in New York, there was a moratorium put on by the governor. And in every state and every city, there's a patchwork of different, kind of laws that people are using. So really, it's necessary that we have a federal plan. We put the most consequential decisions in the hands of the least capable people. People have suffered, have lost their lives. People are going to lose their livelihoods. People might lose their homes. I mean, it's really tragic when you look at how well other countries have handled this crisis, that the United States has failed so dismally.
That does not bode well. And thank you, Faith reporter Nia Gray. That doesn't bode well for a couple of reasons. One, it limits the amount of homes that are on the market. When large investors buy up homes, they sort of control the rental market. And when you're looking for a first time or looking at a first time buyer who wants to buy their first home, there's very few first time homes available because these large real estate companies own these individual houses that would be great for starter homes for families just starting out. Thank you so much, Nia Gray. It's a lot to chew on. Let's move on to Althea Billings, news director, KBOO Radio. Althea, what do you think?
Coronavirus, the pandemic, has certainly laid bare how crucial housing is to our well-being, let alone having the ability to protect ourselves against a deadly pandemic. And as Nia alluded to, eviction moratoriums are a temporary fix. They're staving off an immediate crisis of people being out on the street because they can't pay rent, because they lost their job. But the one coming down the line is, you could argue, even more severe. Months and months of back rent are going to come due, plus the fees and the fines. And at least I'm calling you from Portland, Oregon right now. There is not relief in our system, at least in terms of our eviction moratoriums, up the pipeline of for the landlord, for the mortgage. There hasn't been relief at that level. So basically, the eviction moratorium as it is doesn't give people a clear path forward because they've lost their jobs. And how do they stay in their communities? How do they stay where they are and have this immense debt that they need to pay off? And all of this comes on top of a general housing crisis, which is certainly a problem in the Pacific Northwest, and falls to a dysfunctional public housing system that does little to combat the systemic racism at the root of it that it was at least partially designed to fight against. Another thing that comes to mind is that rents and housing prices have been consistently going up, but wages and buying power for the average person, as you mentioned, Lenita, have been stagnated. Those things are not meeting each other, and that's why we have this crisis. And so, you know, coronavirus shows us how crucial it is to address it. But since July, we haven't had a federal level eviction moratorium. The CARES Act ran out. Now, there is a number, basically, of what kind of rental assistance, emergency rental relief, would be required at a national level to stop this kind of crisis. And it's $100 billion, which has actually been budgeted in the Democratic House passed bill, the HEROES Act, which the Senate has not looked at, dealt with, voted on. But, and yet, big business again is coming up for another bailout. Trump wants to bail out the airlines again, but we can't get a vote on making sure that people don't fall into debt because of all of these things that are out of the side of their control. And one thing I want to highlight, which we've spoken about before when talking about the economy and talking about the stock market, which is that the federal government has a unique ability to look at solving this problem that state and local governments can't. So, right, state and local governments can enforce their own eviction moratoriums, but in terms of relief dollars, the federal government is able to run a deficit budget. State and local governments can't. And because of the coronavirus pandemic and the economic strain that that's caused, they're already going to be facing major cuts due to coronavirus and will definitely be having to make some pretty hard choices about what programs that they fund that end up surviving as a result.
If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable.
From Grassroot News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Our topic today is the coming rental apocalypse. This is our eviction prediction show. Thank you so much, Althea. Let's move on to Cecil, talk show host. Hey, Cecil.
Hi, good day. I hope everyone listened carefully to the important points that the other two commentators made. We are at this point in our nation that we are, I think, about the place where we're about to go over the edge. So even if you had a moratorium on rents or mortgages, and if people were not able to pay their mortgage or their rent because they were unable to have a job, so when the moratorium ends, they still have to pay that. And if they still don't have a job, people are just going further into debt. And as Althea mentioned, in terms of limitations that state and local governments have, they'll have to make some very hard choices about what programs will survive, what programs will not survive, because the lack of income or tax dollars they'll be able to collect. So this winter, and this is going to be a very cold winter for many people in many ways. And you know, the lack of leadership in our national government where they could begin to address some of these issues. As Althea mentioned, a couple of acts that have been passed by the House of Representatives and not acted on by the Senate, on the failure of clear leadership will continue to have a hard impact on all of us. And we may feel that we are safe because either we have a job or we have a home, but we live in communities and neighborhoods, and hard choices are going to be made that will impact all of us. So it's going to be a very cold, cold winter for our nation.
So I had the opportunity to sit down with Secretary Ben Carson yesterday, and I asked him in the middle of this interview, which was wide-ranging, I said, hey, how are you going to make sure that people are going to be able to make rent after the eviction moratorium is over? The moratorium's great, but people are not getting evicted, but eventually the bill comes due. This is what he had to say. Let's take a listen. Eventually, rent will come due for many of these people, and many of them are experiencing permanent job loss. How are Americans supposed to be able to make that eventual rent whenever it does come due?
Well, what people have to recognize is it's always best to go to the source of the problem rather than to put Band-Aids on things. And what is the source of this problem? The source of the problem is this pandemic. Before the pandemic occurred, as you probably know, home ownership was increasing quite substantially in some communities like the African-American community. The wealth gap was shrinking, unemployment was at the lowest levels ever. The economy was extremely strong, and that's the only reason that it's been able to withstand 5 months of shutdown. But that can't last forever, as you point out. Mm-hmm. And that's why you have to go to the source. What is the source? It is the pandemic and the fear of the pandemic. And that's why so much effort is being placed on coming up with a cure, coming up with a vaccine that is actually effective, because the fear of the virus is every bit as devastating as the virus itself, if not more so.
Would you kindly tell me how much HUD is going to, how much you're going to cut from the HUD budget as it relates to housing vouchers? Now, if you don't know, it's okay to say you don't know, Mr. Carson. I don't hold you to things that you don't know.
How okay, much are they going to cut? Let's just move on and say that I don't want to offer a number because it's subject
Why
to
would the Secretary of HUD not give the number, the amount that you're cutting from housing vouchers, Mr. Carson?
Because
you're the Secretary of HUD.
Because
you're making the cut.
Because we've already talked about the total amount of the cuts.
Well, the total amount does not help me when it comes to the housing vouchers. I have people who use housing vouchers, and I need to be able to explain to them, Mr. Carson, how much the cut portends for them. How much, Mr. Carson?
Let's hear your number.
Well, Mr. Carson, forgive me for coughing while speaking, but Mr. Carson, you're the witness testifying today. And if you want a moment to ask someone behind you, I would gladly accord you that moment.
I don't want to open the book and look at the numbers.
I see. Well, you choose not to say how much you're cutting from housing vouchers. All right, how much you're cutting from community block grants, Mr. Carson?
I want to talk about...
Mr. Carson, you don't get to talk about what you want to today. You get to talk about what I want you to talk about. You get to answer the questions that I pose, Mr. Carson.
Yeah, but I also get to answer the question the way
I want.
Well,
you can answer them the way you want, but if you want to show a lack of knowledge, you can do this. It's quite all right, Mr. Carson. So now, how much from community development block grants, Mr. Secretary?
Again, I'm not willing to sit there and
go. So you don't know how much from community development block grants?
I'm not going to go through the list this much, and this much. I think that's
I'll move on, Mr. Carson. I accept your lack of knowledge.
Do you know what an REO is?
An OREO?
An REO. REO.
Real estate.
What's the O stand for?
The organization.
Owned. Real estate owned. That's what happens when a property goes to foreclosure. We call it an REO. Mm-hmm. And FHA loans have much higher REOs. That is, they go to foreclosure rather than to loss mitigation or to non-foreclosure alternatives like short sales than comparable loans at the GSEs. So I'd like to know why we're having more foreclosures that end in people losing their homes with stains to their credit and disruption to their communities and their neighborhoods at FHA than we are at the GSEs.
I would be extremely happy if you'd like to have you work with the people who do that.
Well, Mr. Carson, that was my day job before I came to Congress. So now it's my job to ask you to work with the people.
I'm talking about the people at HUD who do that.
I've spent a decade working with the people at HUD on this problem. When a loan, the most common outcome for an FHA loan that goes into default is REO. There's a conveyance process. Are you familiar with this?
I know about the conveyance.
All right, so let me ask you about conveyance. What actions is HUD taking to change the conveyance process at FHA to address the loss recovery differential between FHA loans and GSE loans?
Well, again, you're getting way down in the weeds here. And
yeah, because it's real American people are out of their houses, so they are literally in the weeds when they are foreclosed on.
Understood. And I'm very happy to put you in contact with the people who deal with that. If I got down in the weeds on every issue, I wouldn't get very far.
Okay, appreciate it. But this has been a problem for years. The Urban Institute issued a major report on this, and I will be happy to send you a copy.
I appreciate you bringing it to my attention.
I want to make sure you... Let me ask you this. Given these problems, the outcome is that FHA is the leading cause of blighted homes in the United States. What can you do about that? Do you understand the relationship between the blight and the servicing problems?
Well, I understand that blight is a huge problem and that...
And that it comes from your agency's inaction on servicing.
I'm not sure that I'm willing to accept that FHA is the cause of all the blight that we have.
I hope you feel differently after you read the report. Thank you.
Professor Johnson calling in from Houston, Texas. Houston is starting to evict people left and right. Or I'm sorry, Texas is starting to evict people left and right.
Right. This is a really difficult problem that to me has been compounded by non-action, making it even more difficult because we really needed a short-term and a long-term strategy. And the first short-term strategy, which was the COVID relief, did help people somewhat.
Nevada's moratorium on evictions is back. Governor Sisolak resurrected that measure to keep people in their homes and help slow the pandemic spread. Nevada's unemployment rate is one of the highest in the nation. People across the valley struggling to pay their rents and their mortgages. However, it's also a burden for landlords. They have their own bills to pay, of course. The state's moratorium replaces the Centers for Disease Control federal moratorium that expires New Year's Eve. Nevada's new protections last through March 31st.
I think that we are going to see a tsunami of people without housing. Even though independently states can have a moratorium, but you can only do that for so long. As you pointed out, there's small real estate owners that can't afford not to pay their mortgages. And I know that the federal government has federally owned property. They've banned evictions for a period of time and have fines in place from $100,000 to $200,000 for corporate landlords. But that can't go on forever. Most of this ends at the end of the year in December. I agree with the previous panelists about the debt. A moratorium does not forgive debt. And how this is going to be repaid, from everything I've read, is being left up to the tenant and the landlord. Now that will not work out. They have two different, you know, agendas. That's gonna be extremely difficult. I understand that a lot of the evictions, as the Faith reporter said, they are already acting and filing these eviction notices. And what will happen is that they may not act on them, because in many states they have only emergency evictions, which I think is if the renter's tearing up the property or there's drugs, those sort of egregious things going on. But the minute these moratoriums expire, then these evictions come into play. And I don't think people have the means, you know, to meet these debts. And these debts will go on, even if they come up with a payment plan. These people are going to be in debt, not just for half of a year, but for years to come. Althea spoke to this, that there's at least $100 billion that needs to be put into play just for emergency rental assistance, keeping people housed and being able to pay something to landlords. That's the minimum it would take to keep things going. And that's just a short-term fix.
It's just a one-month extension to the eviction ban overall. And that eviction ban wasn't really that strong to begin with. There are huge loopholes in it. It requires renters to submit a declaration to the landlord. And so many people don't know about the eviction order, or they don't realize that they need to submit that declaration. So more people will be evicted before January as well, because they don't understand what their rights are. But then, you know, even though this new relief package has rental assistance, it's very unlikely that that rental assistance will start to flow before the current eviction ban ends. I think that what Congress is really hoping is that the incoming Biden administration decides to extend the eviction ban all on their own.
I think we'll be relieved to be out of 2020. 2020 has been a lot of things, but that celebration may very well be short-lived. It's something that needs to be dealt with, and it's a complex issue, and we have T-minus 3 months to deal with it. And this government likes to push things to the edge, likes to shut down the government over the budget. So I am hopeful, I suppose, but not counting on it.
What I think, you know, we do not know what might happen. And the fact is that our government might be in more of a crisis in 3 weeks in whatever happens with the national elections. One would hope that after the elections, the Congress and the executive branch could come together and do something. But I think we might be in so many different crises about the outcome of the elections that the ability for leadership may be absent. And I don't know what will happen?
Yeah, again, I am just hoping that the real estate industry can step up as an industry to try to help support what's happening, to provide housing, to provide affordable housing, and to just not kick out their residents that they claim that they care so much about on their websites, just kick them out on the street. However, there have been real estate groups, industry groups that are lobbying to stop this, to lobbying the government to stop the moratorium, but also to come up with some types of solutions. So it's not just us as concerned folks and have friends and family that might fall into this category and just care about our fellow Americans, but it's also the industry, I feel, is torn. But it's not gonna help anybody. It's definitely gonna be a lose-lose, especially when you have empty units and no one's qualified to rent them.
We have been evicted for 19 days in the pandemic. So we've been living homeless since.
And your socks wet?
When I wake up in the morning, I'm sitting in the front seat of my car. Realization sets in, okay, we've been out here all night long. It don't have to be like that. We tried our best to do our part, and the landlord didn't want to compromise with us.
John and Margaret Eady have been living out of their car since they were evicted from their home on September 29th. They said they were unable to make rent after John's hours were reduced at his trucking job.
And we was comfortable. Then here come Mr. Pandemic. Everything just went from comfortable to uncomfortable real fast.
In early September, the CDC passed a nationwide eviction moratorium, stating that landlords can't force tenants out of their homes for failure to pay rent, except under certain circumstances. However, in Virginia, eviction hearings have actually increased. There's been roughly 35,000 of them in the state since the moratorium was enacted. Many of these renters, like Margaret and John, have nowhere to go.
If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable. Our topic today is the coming rental apocalypse. This is our eviction prediction show.
From Grassroot News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
So, Nia Gray, what didn't we talk about?
No one from the White House has denounced the failed kidnapping attempt of a United States governor, and apparently also the governor of Virginia may have been targeted. What kind of message does that send? It sends that you can have these types of plots and nothing's going to happen. So I'm really worried about voter safety on election day. And then one other thing we didn't talk about are the increased cases. The 50% of the country seeing increased cases in COVID. Will we have a second shutdown this winter?
Althea, what didn't we talk about?
Well, certainly voter suppression. I like that idea for a future show, but as we're recording this, the confirmation hearings for Amy Coney Barrett to join the Supreme Court are happening, and her confirmation could have really widespread implications from everything from the Affordable Care Act, reproductive rights, LGBTQ plus rights, the Voting Rights Act, all this kind of stuff really could be on the line. And the Supreme Court generally, the role that it's played more recently doesn't necessarily match with this history, but it doesn't mean that the Supreme Court isn't important. And there's also this sort of conversation that politicians are dancing around right now of what does it mean to pack the court, and is that a good thing or a bad thing? I think that would be interesting for us to explore later on.
Professor Johnson, and then we'll end with Cecil.
Althea and I have the same topic, which is the Supreme Court justice. I have an ethical and a moral issue with the Federalist Society handing the president a list of names of judges, and that we make this very important decision on lifetime appointments, including other judges, not just the Supreme Court justice, based on what the Federalist Society tells us. And I find it odd that no one questions their appointment. I was about to say that even though she's deemed qualified by the American Bar Association, she is clearly not the most qualified person we have for the Supreme Court. And if you look at her record and compare it with Merrick Garland, who was Obama's nominee, she was a clerk when he had 20 years of experience on very important cases like terrorism, like domestic terrorism cases, the Atlantic bombing. She definitely is not coming to this court or this nomination with any experience even close to that. But no one is talking about that. They're focused on, you know, her ideologies, and she is not speaking to those. And I think it's very important because I think what the other panelists say are true. She could swing this vote that could cost us legal progress, and we could see bad law coming out of this Supreme Court. But they don't make law. I just wanted to call that out.
What is the Federalist Society, please?
The Federalist Society is a very conservative group of intellectuals who have been very astutely shaping politics in this country by investing in certain universities, by identifying stars or people that they see that can move into the political arena and advocate for their points of view. Amy Coney Barrett is one of those people.
I'll shift a little bit. What we did not talk about was sports. And I want to mention not only the NBA playoffs, but not in the typical way. I was most impressed by how the players continue to stand up for social justice throughout the playoffs. And you could not watch the playoffs without it being thrown in your face that Black Lives Matter. So it reminds all of us that regardless of our situation in life, we can make a stand for what is right.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroot News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Coming up next on Let's Talk About Race is The Faith Report with Nia Gray. She's wrestling with the disenchantment of faith.
Hello, and welcome to The Faith Report, where evangelism meets social justice. As we close out another year, I find myself a disillusioned Christian. 2020 was a very challenging year, seeing the climax of white evangelicalism turning into white nationalism, with 75 million Americans who voted for Trump, who many call themselves Christians. So-called Christians blatantly ignoring the cries of Black Lives Matter and silent when immigrant children were ripped from their parents and locked up. They lean into their false theology and worship their false idol in Donald Trump. And we can't forget the sexual scandal of top Christian leaders like Jerry Falwell Jr. and his threesomes with his wife and pool boy. Or Ravi Zacharias, a preacher that authored books defending Christian beliefs, was posthumously accused of sexually abusing multiple women at spas over several years, while his organization ignored the accusations. The pop star pastor Carl Lentz of Hillsong Church ousted due to too many affairs and sexual misconduct. These are the people of God? Sounds like an episode of Big Brother. So I ask myself, how can they use the Christian faith to justify their actions? Is this a do as I say, not as I do situation? How can a Christian with any familiarity with Jesus's ministry support Donald Trump? How can they publicly and shamelessly display such hypocrisy?
White evangelicals have been going down the wrong path for years now. In fact, a 2017 Lifeway survey found that how they're very quite fond of the Bible, but over 50% of them have never even read it. The biblical ignorance that reigns in the white evangelical world is matched only by their ignorance of Christian history, or history in general for that matter. Actually, that's not true. The few lines of scripture they do know is twisted to deceive the selfish and the ignorant. Romans 13 was used by Jeff Sessions to justify the Trump administration family separation policy. They love to throw around Romans 13, which states that Christians are to obey all public officials under all circumstances. However, many biblical scholars dispute this view. The order of authority derives from God, as the Apostle Paul says in Romans 13. For this reason, the duty of obedience for the true Christian is to the origin of the authority. So when the godliness ceases, the obedience for the authority ceases, meaning the authority is given to institutions by God. And when they are not displaying godly or biblical virtues, Christians should speak up and not blindly follow. However, we saw the opposite of this during COVID-19 when local governments had lockdown rules. The churches said, oh no, not us. In this circumstance, we are not going to obey public officials under all circumstances. So I guess it's you follow the scripture whenever you want to. Why do evangelicals pick and choose the law and order scripture and ignore the scriptures like Mark 12:31, love your neighbor as yourself, or the Beatitudes in Matthew? Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Or Galatians 5:22, where Christians are instructed to demonstrate the fruit of the Spirit, which is love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. According to the author Richard T. Hughes, in a Baptist News article, he states the scandal of the evangelical mind includes not only the failure to seriously engage the biblical text or know history, it also includes failure to engage in critical thinking. That failure helps explain why they believe blatant and demonstrable falsehoods for objective truth, and why they fall prey to conspiracy theories, and why they so readily imagine that the demonstrable good is really evil, and the demonstrable evil is really good, which can be found in Isaiah 5:20. Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, who put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. I started this faith report with disillusion, yes, but not rejection. By the grace of God, the illusion has been removed. I have no fanciful thoughts about the church or the temptation that we all face every single day. A pastor once told me the sooner this shock of disillusionment comes to an individual and to a community, the better for both of them. Similarly, Dr. Dietrich Bonhoeffer of Life Together points out, just as surely as God desires to lead us to a knowledge of genuine Christian fellowship, so surely we must be overwhelmed by a great disillusionment with others, with Christians in general, and if we are fortunate, with ourselves. So when we point our fingers at others, we have four more pointing right back at us. God has made it clear that He is to be the center of our worship, not leaders or church. Faith is the assurance that the things revealed and promised in the Word are true, even though unseen through the chaos and the confusion. I was worried that the deceived were perverting God's Word, but I've come to understand that they desire to hear a false doctrine that lines up with their own ambition, to hear what they want to hear. The Bible speaks that the elect, meaning church folk, would be deceived, but I didn't realize it would be so easy. Those of us who know the truth should continue to speak the truth, and the truth shall set us free. This is Nia Gray with your Faith Report.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroot News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Welcome back to Let's Talk About Race. At Let's Talk About Race, we wondered what was the most significant advancement toward human rights in the last 4 years. Our nominee was instrumental in exposing the truth that all Americans are not treated equally under the law. Our nominee exposed the corruption of privilege. Our nominee helped create truth, understanding, and empathy. Our nominee for the most significant advancement toward human rights in the United States and around the world is the camera phone. That's right, the camera phone. This piece of technology allowed human beings all around the world to witness the police being called on black people living their lives, being treated differently by law enforcement. The camera phone exposed the corruption of privilege and forever gave a new definition to the name Karen. The camera phone.
It's illegal to have a charcoal grill in the park here.
No, it's not actually. I just looked at the map. It says this is a designated barbecue area.
No, it's not for a charcoal grill. No charcoal grills are allowed. Do you want to see it? You must not have looked up.
What kind of grill are you not allowed, and why are you so bent out of shape over them being
because
here?
Because it causes extra money from our city to do things when children get injured because of improperly disposed poles.
So are you saying that they're going to hurt children out here, or I mean, like, what is the, with this?
There's laws about this park, and
I know the laws about this park.
And charcoal grills are not allowed here.
So they should go buy a new grill because I just looked
they
at it and it doesn't
be doing
say anything.
Charcoal grills in here. I don't care what.
Are you sure? Are you sure it's not because you don't want black people being out here?
It has nothing to do with their race.
It seems like a new Jim Crow going on because for some reason every time I see it, black people are the ones targeted regarding barbecuing at the lake, and you're a perfect example of it right now. It's two men sitting out here just chilling, and this whole setup is real clean.
I don't
see
care.
They're not.
It's
they don't
not
have loud
a matter
music.
About the clean. It's
you want to call the police on them.
I have called
you want to call the police on them for having a barbecue on a Sunday at the lake.
Yes.
I just looked at the map and it said this map is fine to barbecue.
No, it's not.
It
for
does.
Charcoal. Not for charcoal.
Not a cut.
You
did
can
I just send it to you?
A charcoal grill, but not a charcoal grill.
Okay, well, this is exactly what's the problem with Oakland today.
I'm sorry, I'm in the Ramble and there is a man, African American, who has a bicycle helmet. He is recording me and threatening me and my dog. There is an African American man. I am in Central Park. He is recording me and threatening myself and my dog. And my. I'm sorry, I can't hear you either. I'm being threatened by a man in the Ramble. Please send the cops immediately.
What'd you say we came through?
I'm Tom Austin. I'm a tenant in the building. Are you?
We're all tenants in this building.
What office?
Don't worry about that. We're not saying
what office?
So we have an office here, and this guy came accusing us we can't be here.
What office are you in?
Don't worry about that. We don't have to tell you.
I'm calling 911 now.
Go ahead.
As you guys can see, we're dealing with racism here.
A lawyer representing two Pittsburgh high school students plans to sue the school and police for what they claim is a pattern of abuse targeting black students. Video of one incident shows a school resource officer putting a student in a headlock before pushing him down and then later using a taser.
The video, recorded in March 2015, shows Ahmad Williams waiting in the principal's office after being sent there by a teacher. He's exchanging words with school resource officer Steve Shaulis. Suddenly, Shaulis confronts Williams, putting him in a headlock and eventually dragging him to the hallway. Principal Kevin Murray helps Officer Shaulis hold Williams down while a teen is handcuffed and tasered. At a press conference, Williams' attorney Todd Hollis said this is one of three known incidents at Woodland Hills School District.
If a picture speaks 1,000 words and that picture clearly does, this picture clearly does, then a video has to speak 1,000,000.
She thinks it's cute that her driver almost hit my kids. And she thinks she needs to take a video of it.
I'm being threatened by a man in the Ramble. Please send the cops immediately.
You want to call the police on him for having a barbecue on a Sunday at the lake?
Yes.
All of these women have been identified as Karens by the internet. The term has burst into the scene as racial tensions reach a boiling point in the U.S. The phrase may be new, but Karen-like behavior has been a constant in this country's history.
I don't care what you think I'm acting like.
None of these women are actually named Karen, but to many people, they embody a certain persona in American society. A white person who uses their status and power to threaten or humiliate people of color. Actress and comedian Amanda Seales has been outspoken about who exactly Karen is. Here's how she defined the term.
A Karen is a white woman whose oblivion of their privilege causes them to act in a way that is oppressive and oftentimes insane.
She is crazy.
You're crazy. See?
Some might think that Karen is just a loud white woman asking for the manager, you know, disrupting your customer service experience. But I'm here to tell you, Karen goes a lot deeper.
You need to leave. You're not a part of this. You need to leave. You're not a part of this. No.
A Karen is a white woman who is a descendant of those who came before her, who could scream and get a black man killed, who could point and get a black woman murdered.
The use of Karen has become much more serious as protests erupt around the world following the death of George Floyd. People with Karen-like behaviors have made national news within the past few years and continue to be exposed.
Please don't come close to me.
Sir, I'm asking you to stop recording me.
Please don't come close to me.
A white woman appears to call police, accusing a black man of threatening her after he asked her to put her dog on a leash.
This woman don't want to let a little girl sell some water.
Little girl was trying to sell bottled water so she could go to Disneyland. Now her story has exploded. That video of her neighbor calling the police now viewed more than a million times.
Teresa Klein accused a 9-year-old boy of sexual assault, and the store's surveillance video tells a different story, clearly showing the boy's backpack accidentally brushed against Klein.
For me, these videos are very triggering. I think that there's a certain level of like, oh, ha, 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 they're annoying when you're just watching it. But when you're in that situation, it is not an annoyance. It is a disruption of your being.
Ma'am, can you just back up just a tad so I can talk to her? Thank you.
Sure. You know that as a person of color, specifically a black person, you are the one who is going to be in the situation of having to prove your innocence.
Our nation's current unrest shows how these behaviors can be much more dangerous than we think. Unfairly policing people of color is embedded deep in America's history. Karen just happens to be the new name for it. Take the 1955 murder of Emmett Till, a 14-year-old black boy who was lynched after being accused of flirting with a white woman in Mississippi. She admitted her claims were false decades later. So Karen isn't always just a woman who likes to speak to the manager. It's much deeper than that. There's a common thread throughout American history, with people of color being targeted for existing in traditionally white spaces, or for doing something most would describe as normal or harmless behavior. And we've seen over and over again that these types of altercations can lead to serious consequences for those targeted, sometimes even resulting in death.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational journalistic roundtable focusing on the issue of race. From Grassroots News, I'm your host and moderator, Lanita Duke.
I'm Althea Billings. I'm the news director here at KBOO.
I'm Cecil Prescott. I'm a talk show host.
I am Professor Johnson, political commentator from Houston, Texas.
Hello, this is Nia Gray, the host of The Faith Report, where faith and social justice meet.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race. Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you. for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by Grassroot News Northwest.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Tune in to Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush, Tuesday nights on KBOO.